Pro Savings Days are on at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, MyLowe's Pro Rewards members get an additional 5% off when you buy 5 or more select GE, Whirlpool, and Electrolux kitchen or laundry major appliances. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 123. Discount valid to MyLowe's Pro Rewards members only. Exclusions and other restrictions apply. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for details. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Do You Remember with, well, Carrot Spain and me, Tony Kelly. Tony here, of course. I'm on my own doing this intro mainly because myself and Carl recorded this wonderful, wonderful episode with our friend Phil Jupitus, which is just, honestly, just a brilliant, brilliant chat. But it was such a brilliant chat that after we finished the chat, we just continued chatting off mic and off camera, and then we just went to our separate hotels. Phil and Carl were gigging and I was getting ready to go to bed to gig the next day. So we actually forgot to record the intro together, did myself and Carl. And yeah, so basically we were just having too much fun and we didn't do the intro. So I'm doing it here on my own without Carl. But honestly, this was such an incredible chat. Like, I'll tell you how much we all enjoyed it. When I kind of had to wrap it up as producer of the podcast as well as co-host, I said, no, we're going to turn it off now. We turned it off and Phil actually said, why are we stopping? And as a podcast host or someone who's even involved in a podcast, that's just probably the best compliment you can get, I think. But anyway, I'm not going to go on. This is such a brilliant chat with Phil. We talk so much music. We talk all the things that influenced him as a performer, as an artist. We talk about a little bit of everything. But this was, honestly, for me, such an interesting conversation that we all got involved in, that we all really enjoyed. And by the way, before I even throw to the episode, such a huge thank you to all the lads, Paddy and Paul and all the lads at the Red Cow Hotel and Inn. They fed us on the day in a beautiful carvery and then they provided us a room upstairs in the function room that we could record this podcast because we were stuck for a venue. I'm from Waterford, Carl's from Limerick, Phil is from London, and we had nowhere to really record it in a neutral venue, and the lads at the Red Cow provided us with that. And we are genuinely so, so thankful for that beautiful venue. By the way, the food itself in the carvery in the Red Cow was incredible. We all can't recommend it enough. We even did a little video on the day for the Red Cow that they could put out in their socials to big them up as well. But beyond bigging anybody up, it was tremendous. And also the hospitality was so, so much appreciated. Thank you so much, lads. Now, without any more further ado, please enjoy this chat where we all remember different things. But mainly, the great Phil Jupitus.
There's something about the cleaning standards of most venues. It's like, it can something be appealing about the sticky floor, but that means you've just not been cleaning.
Yeah.
You've not been cleaning.
It's not an aesthetic, it's just laziness.
I remember, do you remember the stickiest venue floor?
That was Castle.
Well, whatever you went to, as a punter and you're walking across.
Castle was in Limerick. There was nothing.
The Marquee in Wardour Street.
No,
it was incredible.
Oh, the Marquee. Sticky. Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
It's not just an Irish thing, then, the sticky floor.
No.
Well, it's apparently CBGBs. They always talk about the CBGBs.
Oh, don't you give me the bit of the CBGBs.
Please don't mention the Bee Gees.
Didn't Andy Peters work with the CBGBs?
The least punk rock thing ever associated with CBGBs. That statement. Anyway, we're now recording. We're
here. Oh, Jesus.
Are we on?
Yeah, we've been on.
But have we?
It was only when we started talking about the sticky floor are we on.
That was the gold, though, wasn't it?
I never told you what I wanted to do with the airport. I only told
you
about 10
airport?
Minutes before you arrived. Yeah. I've been meaning to do this for years. Was just right. Mum or dad on a piece of paper and stand there. Because obviously you'd have recognised me, but just the looks I would have got from other people. It's just a fun thing I've always wanted to do.
Most people want to come out of an airport arrivals with someone with their name on it, but
yeah,
Carol wants to do it.
I've had my name spelled in so many different ways. Not that I've been collected much, but
yeah. Oh, I've had to, yeah. Well, of course, as you might imagine, there's been a few.
Yeah.
Jupius, Julius, Junius.
Jill Fupitus.
Jupiter.
Phil Jupiter.
Dr. Bill Juniper.
Do you know the Spanish naming thing?
Go on.
So, like, well, I know he's Argentinian, but Lionel Messi is Lionel Messi Cucitone or something like that.
Yeah.
Because the third part is the mother's name.
Okay.
But when I'm, like, want your full name when you're registering in a hotel, so I'd be Carl Thomas Spain.
Okay.
And they go, hello, Mr. Thomas. And I'm going, how are you picking that one? But that's your surname in the Spanish systems.
Right.
I only realized, I was like, and I knew about it. I just never, I was reading about it there recently. I went, that's why I'm an idiot.
I'm sure that's what the listener is tuning in for as well, to learn the way the Spanish name
just
goes.
These little nuggets.
Yes. Facts. Phil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We promised you nuggets.
Yes. And what a beautiful feed we got here at the Red Cow Hotel.
The Red Cow. Oh my God. It's like they sacrificed the Red Cow
there
for us.
There was a legendary London pub gig called the Red Cow back in the 1970s that would have played host to, you know, like Nick Lowe and Kilburn and the High Roads and Dr. Feelgood, people like that. You know?
Well, that's more of the conversation that fits into the theme of the podcast, Phil. So maybe that's where we should start then. Okay. Obviously, that type of thing is very influenced on your life, your performances, you as a character in general.
Yeah.
What's your earliest kind of memory of stuff like that, whether it be gigs, venues, all that kind of thing?
Well, I grew up in a pub in Barking. My grandfather was a publican and He had a pub that was on Ripple Road in Barking. It was called the Brewery Tap. It was an Eindkoop boozer. That was the name of the brewery.
Is it still there?
It is, but it's not a pub anymore. It is now an African restaurant. You can get some top-notch Nigerian food in there now, you know. But it's not a pub anymore. And my granddad, on a Sunday, the saloon bar had a band. So we're talking about me now from the age of like 3 up until 6 on a Sunday night when I'm in bed, you know, gone to bed for school, just hearing through the floor. So that kind of, you know, and he had, so it's one of those classic kind of the very minimal pub bands that you would have in the East End in the 1960s and 70s. And so it's quite often, I mean, the original traditional East End was just someone on the piano, but granddad, he kind of, things had ramped up a bit. So he had a drummer and an organist.
Wow.
And a personality vocalist who was responsible for the why does that intonation so just belong to pubs? Just that.
But not only that, the intonation, to me, that would be a London pub, like what you're doing. Not just a pub, but that intonation is very London.
Because so Ireland's got the show band thing.
Yes.
So your vocalists are that much fruitier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is that kind of sort of, you know, you've got
Brendan Boyer and the Royal Soul Band.
You've got a little bit more of that sort of country via the traditional sort of 30s pop great American songbook sort of stuff that was going on here. But I don't know where that where did that come from?
There was probably one influential guy back in the day.
Because it's not as if Tony Bennett was.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Sinatra. So yeah, so it was. I do remember. And of course, you know, as a child of sort of 5 years old, I was fascinated by the kit. You know, so I would go down into the saloon bar when the pub was shut. So this is back in the 60s when, you know, pubs would shut from...
Oh, the afternoon.
Yeah. Oh, the afternoon shut.
They were open at 12 till 2 and then shut from 2 till 6.
Oh.
So there'd be a 4-hour close and then they'd open again in the evening. And so I'd go down. So I'd get back from school and the saloon bar would be empty. And if you could, you know, imagine a child having the run of a
pub,
a big old, the room, just the size. Remember the size of the room. You're running around the tables and things. And so it's a very big saloon bar because it was also like the function suite.
Mm-hmm.
And then between the saloon bar and the public bar, which was again quite big, but a lot grottier, was the off sales, the off license. So before in Britain, before there were supermarkets were selling booze and that. You could only buy beer from off sales.
And there would be
off licenses and wine stores. So yeah, so every pub would sell. So I remember because I was a child, I was allowed in off license. I wasn't allowed in the licensed drinking premises. So I wasn't allowed in the public bar or saloon bar, but I was allowed in the off sales. And I'd sit on, I was a fetching young child. I was vain. I was a good looking child. So I'd sit on there and little old ladies would give me threepenny bits.
Oh, wow.
Give me threepences and sixpences.
This was just between the ages of 3 and 6, did you?
This is, yeah, that's when
I was
embarking.
Did you work there or anything like that?
Well, no, funny enough, I did work. We had a Scottish head barman called Jock, and I'd help him bottle up in the morning. So I'd go down the cellar.
Oh, right.
And
yeah.
I'd do the baby bottles. So I used to do bottling up when I was a child in the pub. It's really easy job. Really easy. You just look at the thing and he'd go and get me, you know, 10 bottles of bitter lemon or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And are you up in the bed hearing that lounge style music going, yeah, I fancy a bit of this, I fancy...
Well, so my mum, so there was that, my mum had a radiogram. My mum, so the first album, the first music I remember being able to listen to repeatedly at my own control. So aside from the fact that my auntie Josie, who was like the youngest daughter of my mum's 4 siblings, she was only sort of 10 years older than me. So she was like a teenager. So she was into Motown and she was a suedehead as well. So she was into the blue beat and reggae. So I was hearing Trojan and Motown out of her bedroom.
Wow.
I was hearing coming through the floor in a very indistinct way on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, so we're talking 67, 68, about the birth of Radio 1, pop music first being sort of hitting the airwaves in Britain. And so...
Was the 60s a good time for music?
So yeah,
any bands we might have heard of?
There is a photo of me. I'll send you it to kind of stick up in association with the pub when it goes out. Of me, I had a little plastic Beatles guitar.
Beautiful.
That I used to, and I am quite wisely covering up Ringo.
Oh. Poor old Richie.
I've got my arm over Ringo.
I my mother used to bake every Sunday, and she had a radio with a tape recorder thing on it. And I remember she used to listen to the same tape every week.
Yeah.
And the song I always, like every week, was Cats is a theme from Cats, isn't it?
Cats, yeah.
And that song, if I hear it, my mum is there.
That's the idea of it's incredible. That sense memory thing, isn't it? Music does that for me very, very much.
But the comedy element was, I remember my little brother Mark one day going, oh, that program is always on a Sunday. And and I could see my mother laughing, and I twigged and went, no, that's a cassette, you know, and I said nothing. That's to play the same songs. I mean,
so the first LP I had was The Jungle Book, the Walt Disney's Jungle Book. So I was a very early fan of Louis Prima. There's not many 5-year-olds in West Essex that are enjoying the Vegas stylings of Louis Prima and
is
his
that
band.
Like word for word, note for note.
It's a but non e, happy but that what known hers ever deck babadood he. I'm going to violate some copyright stuff here, so I won't
scatting
carry on.
And,
but yeah, no.
Scatting in the mouth,
King
trumpet.
Of the Swingers, yeah. And just the songs. And so as a kid, that's the first record that I used to.
Yeah,
myself, and because if you get and your older listeners will, those of them at the time that remember it happening, when Disney did the soundtrack albums of the films, it would be someone from the film telling the story, so it'd be like
that's
an audio book.
Oh, yeah, the in between.
So
yeah,
it was Sterling Holloway was Bagheera is telling the story in a cut with the songs, you know.
But isn't it incredible, though? Like, we're from different eras, the three of us, right? And yet, I would have grown up with cassette tapes of that. They had a magazine that they would bring out with the Jungle Book and the Beauty and the Beast, whatever it was.
Yes.
Now, my sister had them.
Yeah.
And obviously, I had to pretend like, oh, she's putting them on. But I loved it.
Why does she keep putting them on in my room?
Yeah, my Fisher-Price tape recorder.
I find that was always quite interesting, that kind of, if you did have a sibling, there's a mate of mine, Mark, his older brother Dave was only 2 years older, but that's such a massive difference in terms of sort of how hip you are.
Mm.
So if you had a big brother, He's into slightly different stuff to you.
Right.
And also you've got your own taste. And it's like when you become, you have that autonomous sense that you're developing the own stuff you like. So Mark's brother Dave. So we liked Slade and the Absolutely. Sweet. And Wizard, Susie Quattro. We like the glam stuff.
My dad
and the pop,
that,
David Essex. Whereas, so David liked Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Oh, yes.
And Bowie.
Yeah.
And, you know, and getting on for sort of the early prog stuff, so Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. So I do remember one time, and every once in a while, when the cool older brother would let you in his room to, and then they'd play a record and you'd be allowed to kind of sit there very quietly and listen to it.
Yeah.
And also he had a guitar. And I do remember hitting his record player with his guitar and making a record jump, and we just had to leave the room, and I never went in that room again.
I thought you invented like hip hop.
it was I remember what it was, Aladdin Sane.
Aladdin Sane after that.
I scratched his copy of Aladdin Sane.
My older cool brother was my cousin Darren from up the road, and all the music and some of it he just get borrow an album. Mm. So like things like the Smiths, well, he would have liked the Smiths and the Clash and stuff like that, but my two brothers, one brother had no real interest in music, and the only album he ever bought was Jean-Michel Jarre's Concerts in China, which to me
that's niche.
That's just the MacGyver music.
Yeah.
And the other brother was into Chris de Burgh, Bobby Goldsboro, real kind of saccharine sweet stuff, and it used to just annoy me. Now, I'm into pop. Like, I was a huge Wham fan, my own taste.
Yeah, you love that.
And I love George, everything George did. But, but the Smiths, and I always, I mean, you would have had, would your taste be quite eclectic as well? You're not going to be, it's just this type of music.
I think that coming from a time, so if you take punk as hitting properly in 76, so I was 14, and I was away at school. And so you're at 14, you're still working yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
And punk did seem, two things about punk. Firstly, it was like rough boy music.
Right.
And secondly, it was part of a sort of hip scene thing. And so the people that got into it did their utmost to exclude other people.
Yeah.
The
punkiest thing you can probably do. So it did become a bit of a sort of, so it's a bit like the Bowie people were really, I'm sure he'd find it himself if he was still around, and you know, you do know your fans were absolute dickheads to everybody else at school, you know, and they were I found Bowie fans certainly in Essex and where I was were really snobby, and it's like you don't understand, you don't know, and it's I'm much more kind of open and what is this and
what's new
and what's different, which was what was really good about John Peel when I started listening to Peel in 76.
Yeah.
And it's just this guy playing such different stuff every night with this monotone voice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got, that was The Fall and the sound of Big Gun Masters Breakout. Coming up after this, absolutely from Matumbi. And you've got this completely varied musical thing with this guy with this very flat sort of voice, no passion in it. He's not a, hey, what a great record. So you're used to Radio 1 during the day. It was, hey, we got this coming up now. And people speak to you, good morning and welcome. So I always remember that being a very kind of a paradigm that I wanted to break when they gave me Six Music. They said,
right.
So when I came on air on Six Music in the morning, I sounded like a man at 7 o'clock in the morning at a job that he's not entirely sure he wants to be at. So I'd play two records without even talking to them. So then at about 10 past 7, I go, good morning, you're right?
That's right.
We all woke up today.
Well, we're still here. Here's another record. I'll tell you what's on the show. And I'd slowly wake up.
Yeah.
I always remember, and Sean Keaveney had said, when he took breakfast over from me, he said, that was the one thing I liked, was that you woke up gradually. There was none of that. Good morning.
Yeah.
There was none of that at all. And I don't know. It wasn't for everybody because they've got one now that does that. You know, Nick Grimshaw, who was at Radio 1.
That's right.
He left Radio 1 12 years ago. He's now breakfast at Six Music, and it sounds like his show did on Radio 1. He's a very good professional broadcaster.
Yeah.
But it wasn't how I understood the remit of Six Music to be, which was an alternative. But now, because Six Music has actually become the preeminent music station for
Radio 1. The alternative becomes the mainstream. That's the way we go.
Which is what happened to punk. Which is what happened to everything.
That's punk. Like,
yeah.
You were saying like punk, gatekeeping and punk. That's the most punk thing I've ever heard. It's like, I love punk music, right? I was 14, 15, growing up in Waterford in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
And then the kind of... the pop punk scene in the US was making its way over here when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
So I was learning about Green Day and Blink-182, The Offspring, all that kind of stuff. And then I was going, well, hang on, my Uncle Billy's got the Sex Pistols, The Clash, The Ramones. And I was putting all this together. But then you might go to, I don't know, a concert in town where all the local bands are playing. And there might be one guy who's after dyeing his hair green.
Yeah.
Or he shaved the mohawk because he was a louder, you know. And I'm going, I'm showing up with my Liverpool jersey on me. And he's going, you can't be into punk music because you've a Liverpool jersey on you.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, I'm not shaving my head into a mohawk. You know, but that it's constantly gone on, the gatekeeping and the, I suppose, the provisos.
I think the thing is, it's a tribalism. And it's, you feel, you do get very proprietorial about something that you love. And so with me, I mean, being... I mean, a lot of comedians are neurodivergent, and it's no surprise, it's why they do what they do. But you...
78.2%.
But the,
well, not me.
Hard 87. The way that you kind of... you get into some... so, like, there was a band I really got into called The Members, who did... Sound of the Suburbs is a song that you might have heard. You know, it was their main hit. And I started sort of following them. And it's interesting because I started following them when their decline started.
Okay.
So I basically started following a band that were on the way out.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to watch. So the first time I went to see them, they were headlining at what was the venue in Hammersmith? The hotel in Hammersmith that had the... can't remember the name of it. But it was a... It was a hotel function suite venue, and it would hold about 1,500 people, and they were headlining there. And the first time I saw them was the biggest gig I saw them at, and then they just very slowly
made their way down.
Wow!
And to the point where I went to see them at the University of East London on the Mile End Road. Which I think is the college that Jarvis was at, possibly.
Oh, right, yeah.
But he wouldn't have been then. He still would have been a kid in Sheffield then. But so it's in the Mile End Road. I remember going to this weird room in the Mile End Road. I remember that the support act singer was Bollock Naked. Absolutely.
That's a great name for
and
a band.
And we're just like, yeah. I just remember us coming in and there's this guy, naked guy on the stage. And I'm like, well, fair play to you, son, but this is more about you than it is about...
could you remember what time of year it was?
And what's the air conditioning like?
I'll give you an October. October, but I think he knew someone in the crowd. Yeah. So, and they came on, and I do vividly remember me and my mate Brian and Clive and Nick Langford, I think it was, the four of us being at the front going nuts, and there just being no one behind us. So it was just,
oh, wow.
So there's about, I think there were maybe 20 people watching them.
Mm.
That was one of the last times I saw them. Then they've sort of subsequently reformed. They did. I paid them a couple of grand to get back together and do my 45th birthday party.
Wow.
At the 100 Club, which they were very grateful for because they never played the 100 Club when they were... in their pomp,
yeah.
So,
but that definitely does tie in with what you're saying about comedians, neurodivergence. I've recently been diagnosed myself.
Last week,
actually,
as a comedian.
Yeah, no one's ever going to make
it's
that.
It's the same thing.
Yeah,
you know,
but it's true. But I know what you're saying though about the hyperfixations about different things, but music especially, like. There's different bands and stuff like, and you go, I could pinpoint the amount of times I've fixated on bands and stuff like that. Like, Carol, even you with the George Michael thing, like, that's your...
it's one of them, but there's loads over the years.
But
yeah,
he's definitely
your
favourite, though.
But I love him, sorry to be making about me, but I remember seeing the first Top of the Pops appearance, which was Young Guns. And when you see it repeated now, I just remember watching it going, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And it's George in a sleeveless brown leather jacket. And now you look at it with the turned up jeans kind of folded in.
My memory of Wham is pre that. So it's
They made it.
So it's when they did the song about signing on. What was the one about?
Young Guns was their first. Bad Boys.
No.
Young Guns was the first appearance on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, but no, they
Wham Rap was. They released Wham Rap, but it failed.
Wham give a bam, but don't give a damn because the Benefit Gang are going to pay. Yeah. So they did Wham Rap on the Tube. And Tube made a little, I don't mean on the trains, Carl.
I thought you meant on the trains.
Holly Yates and Jules Holland.
On the Channel 4 music show, The Tube, they did that. And Channel 4, they were quite imaginative in their music. So they made a little funny film about Wham. And I remember it showed Andrew Ridgeley getting up and getting his car. They've got a gig and going round to pick up George.
Oh, that's the kind of,
And knocking on the front door and opening the front door. And George Michael stood there in his pyjamas with a really gimpy look on his face. And I just remember thinking, oh, these lads are a laugh.
Yeah.
But a month later, they're heartthrobs and they're pop stars and they're not funny anymore. And I'm like, but they seem to have a lot of humour about them. And he was from my mate, JoJo Smith knew George really well from the club scene. And
Right.
So she was on the music press. She was a press officer for record companies. She knew everyone in the music scene.
It's funny that the amount of stories that come out after he died about how generous he was, the donations he made. I don't want anyone knowing, like Richard Osman was telling the story of he worked on Deal or No Deal and the woman said, I wanted to get, you know, money for some operator or something. And he went, I want to donate this, but please don't tell her who it is. Yeah. And now that George is dead, he felt it's okay to tell that story. But I'll tell you afterwards who the comedian was. He went, oh, I met him. I didn't like him at all. And I felt really bad. And then I went afterwards, actually, I'm not a big fan of you. The comedian. And I was like, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I'm closer to George. Maybe George has had a good
sense. Maybe George had a point.
Yeah.
Same birthday as me.
Really?
Oh, happy birthday.
It was yesterday.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Phil.
And it would have been George Michael's, would have been 62 yesterday.
Wow. Yeah, I shouldn't know that, but I do.
Well, you kind of did.
Peter Blake, Carly Simon, George Michael and Bill Juniper.
Imagine knowing that. You're so vain.
But he did have a great sense of humour. Just kind of even to segue onto something else, but like, you think about him sending himself up in extras with Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and stuff
George
like that.
Did George meet you? Was he lucky enough?
I was going to say
you must have.
No, it's weird because we had a lot of friends in common. I mean, D. C. Lee, Paul's first wife.
Oh wow, yeah, she was.
She was one of Wham with
Paul
Shirley.
Weller's wife. She was the
Pepsi
she was
Shirley
pre-Pepsi Pepsi.
Yeah.
Right.
So she was in the first iteration of Wham. He knew Crowley really well. He knew Gary really well. I know Gary. So he knew Paul. He was mates with Paul. That sort of there was this
was
kind
he mates
of
with Paul Weller.
He knew Paul. They were pals.
Yeah.
The thing is, they're club kids. They're all disco kids.
Yeah.
All that. And so it was interesting because, you know, talking about sort of that melange of music you end up into, coming from Essex. Disco was huge. The club scene in Essex was massive. You've got the Gold Mine at Canvey, you've got Tots in Southend, you've got the Pink Toothbrush in Rainey, which is where Depeche Mode cut their teeth. It used to be called Crocs. They had a live crocodile in a tank as you went in.
Of course they did.
Crocs in Rainey. You know, you remember all that mad excess of the 70s and 80s in discos you couldn't get away with now.
You had a Celtic Tiger back then.
Actual Tiger, yeah. But so Depeche Mode and
because Gary Kemp does that now on Instagram.
Yeah?
Where you go around and go, oh, Spandau Ballet played here, blah, 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 and all this. So they're probably all the same places.
And then there were people like, you know, and then there was Chris Hillman, who was the DJ down in Kent. There was the 06 that was out on. I remember going to see John Cooper Clarke at the 06,
amazing,
which is out by the airport in Southend. You know, I saw the Damned play the Pink Toothbrush. I saw Aswad at Cliffs Pavilion in Southend. What was sort of interesting at the minute, and it's happening in parallel with you recording this, is there's an exhibition called The Scene by the Sea, which has been put together by an artist called Charles Sharman Cox, who's part of the Thames group of artists. And they've got people together to make art about all the music venues in Essex. So it's weird because I've been chatting a lot to people about the old
and was,
places
was this
we used
two
to
nights
go.
A week, three nights a week you're going to gigs or?
Yeah, well, because I was working as a civil servant and I had a girlfriend, you know, I was going out with Sally at the time. She was at uni in Kent. And so I'd go mostly
college
to
gigs there and stuff like that.
I saw UB40 at Kent. I saw Bad Manners in Margate. That got smashed up by Nazis.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
During the war.
it felt like they got up on the stage and ruined the gig.
Really?
Doug used to hate that, yeah. I mean, actually, Sieg Heilin, you know. Yeah, yeah. Sort of, just all kicked off. It was horrible.
They played the Bundoran Sea Sessions a few years ago. It was during
Bad Manners or the Nazis?
2016, Bad Manners.
No, they're still going.
Yeah, they're still
going. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I went to see Potato 5 an instrumental style ska band in the manner of the Scatterlights or the Scar Flames from Tokyo. They're a real old school ska band. And I met a couple of Bad Manners. And it was like, they came up and my mate Tim went, oh, this is Phil, he's a bit of a fan of Bad Manners. I went, oh, fan of Bad Manners, are you? What's your favourite track? And they're sitting there waiting for me to go Can Can.
Yeah.
And I go, well, I really like Gherkin off of Go Shits, Bad Manners.
Oh my God, you're over.
And they're like, oh yeah, no, that's really... Then they're away because they found a nerd.
Mike Peter, I don't know, The Alarm or ever on your radar. Yeah. Yeah. Mike Peters passed away, the lead singer of The Alarm.
Did, yeah.
And it's more about the music in Britain, the music fan, which I would consider, you know, for certain bands. I went to see The Alarm on my own in Wolverhampton when I was there in college. And I realised this thing of these people, there's people in the room, they're only here to see The Alarm. They mightn't come to a gig for another couple of years until The Alarm again.
Yeah.
So he's on stage. I think he's the only original member. And he goes, this was the B-side to our second single. And the guys in there shouting out the name of the song.
Yeah.
And they knew every word. And I'm going, I'm just here for 68 Guns and a few more. But I passed him in a services, one of those services on the motorway. I was doing a tour. And Mike Peters went, Pat went, Mike Peters. And he just looked at me. Thanks for the music, man. Thank you. And I walked away and went, God, you got one right for a change.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not good meeting someone. Oh, but it was just a nice word and gone.
I met Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin and I fell to the floor, prostrated myself in front of him in a corridor at the BBC.
This never happened before.
And I just went,
thank you so much.
Like I was nearly crying.
What did he say?
And he went, get up. And then I did the same to Toots from Toots and the Maytals.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, there you go.
And I was like, thank you, sir. Thank you so much for the music. Get up off the floor. Get up off the floor.
we might have to edit him out doing the voice.
No, it's okay.
Robert Plant's from Wolverhampton.
It's contextual.
It's okay. There's a guy on TikTok now who does Princess Diana if she was Jamaican and he's white and it's one of the most popular things. So,
oh, yeah, really? I
it's quite funny. No, it is. It's genuinely, it sounds crass, but it's actually very funny.
I saw someone recently talking about somebody and goes, oh, that fella, he makes TikToks. They're called clocks or watches. What are you talking about?
Stop with the baby talk. The only time I've ever had a real, like, I suppose an iconic, like with an iconic musician, I met Lou Reed.
Oh, wow.
Oh, dear God.
I met Lou Reed, and I'm actually jealous. I showed you my Bowie tattoo. I'm going to flash you my Lou Reed Transformer when I'm showing you around now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I've got Lou Reed from Transformer on my arm. I was obsessed with this album, especially my first year in college in New York. I had it on my iPad. Again, go back to Neurodivergency. I was listening to it over and over and over.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to it anyway, my dad's. But like, I was working as an usher in an off-Broadway theatre at the time. Mm. And it was usually just kind of weird stuff that would go on in there. But on that night...
such a good usher. He should have been on Broadway.
I was just off-Broadway. I was more niche. But his wife, Laurie Anderson, was doing a poetry reading. And I went, surely not. It couldn't. And I showed a...
Would he show up?
I showed a kind of pair of patrons to their seats and I turned around and I hit into a shoulder
Why did you
of
do
a
that?
Smaller, like kind of a small man, but he was wearing a leather jacket and I went, oh God. And I just put my hands on him and I'm sorry about that. And he felt very slight, but I never clocked his face.
Yeah.
And I walked back and it was an older man who was a volunteer there and he said it and it was exactly in this tone. He kind of went, oh, Mr. Lou Reed, like that. And I went, sorry? And he goes, that was Lou Reed you just banged into. And I went, no.
And you collapsed.
And I honestly turned around, I saw him, I could see the curls, and I just went, oh my God, I have to go down. And he goes, you're going to lose your job. And I went, I'm going to lose my $6.50 an hour job.
Yeah.
When am I going to get to meet Lou Reed? So I actually made my way through the line. I was like, excuse me. I went, Lou, notoriously grumpy man.
Yeah.
He looks up at me and he goes, yeah. And I said, I have to shake your hand. And he goes, why?
Oh, good.
And I just went, Transformer. And he goes, and what else? And I went, everything else. And he goes, do you have to shake my hand? And I goes, absolutely. And he just stuck his hand out. And I shook his hand. I just went, I'm from Waterford. My dad, I'm walking the wild side, and my dad. And I was listening to it on the train. And he goes, is that it? And I went, yeah, that's it. And he went, thank you. And I went, goodbye. And he went,
you've got a flight. Like,
I really did. Yeah, but honestly, it was the moment of my life. It was one of the greatest things. But it just
did you drink sangria in the park?
I drank a lot in the park, and the hidden meaning behind that song was not so hidden at the time. But no, it was honestly. So I get what you mean about dropping to your knees. I actually roaming charges and stuff, WhatsApp, all that wasn't around. This was like 2009.
Yeah.
I went back and I actually texted my dad on an American phone. It must have cost me about a fiver to send the message just to say I met Lou Reed.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's maybe one or two people that would do that to me now. I think I'd be cooler. I've seen people and go, oh, leave him alone.
Right.
But I shouldn't confess to this, but I remember joking with someone and it was kind of half joking that when George was outed as being gay,
yeah.
And I think anyone that was a fan knew for years, you know, that he was gay.
Sure.
But someone goes, yeah, he goes cruising in, what's it, Hampstead Heath or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I went, I wonder if I went just walking around at night, would I run into him? And I can't remember who I was, it was a comic, and I was going, do you know, if I've always talked about moving to London. I wonder, would I get a place near Hampstead and just go for walks at night and go, did you meet George? And he goes, I thought it was George, but it was a 5'3" Asian guy in the end. I had to make him breakfast. But I was like, but I genuinely think it's someone like Joe, it would have been too much for me to meet.
Yeah.
Maybe Cantona would have been another one. I just would find it difficult to be in his presence. Most other people that I've admired, I'd be fine.
The reason why I'm talking about music so much is that I wanted to talk to you so much about music. But like, I think, now I could be wrong, you can correct me here, Carol, but I think anyone who's
in
performances, comedians, actors, I think everyone wants to be a rock star. I think that's the thing. Maybe that's just me.
I think, well, I always had this thing that there's obviously, it's natural when you're a creative. I think that creatives and people with fizzy brains suffer from FOMO, massively suffer from that. Fear of missing out. They're made from fear of missing out. And I always had that there was this creative circle with show-offs, which is what we are, which is, I think, that...
I haven't spoken in a couple of minutes.
I think that comedians want to be rock stars. I think rock stars want to be actors, and I think actors want to be comedians.
There you go. Very good. I like that.
Yeah.
Because actors... So I would argue... That's when great. I spent time with actors, and I remember there was a bunch of lads, and I did... When I was in Mike Bassett, England manager...
Oh, yeah!
I was with some lads that had been in the RSC, and we used to sit there and argue about who had the more difficult job. And I'm like, and they go, no way we could do what you do. And I'm like, no, there's no way I could do. They went, anyone could learn to act. We couldn't learn to be comedians. Wow. I'm like, yes, you could, because it's just about attitude and balls and keeping your confidence. And I couldn't remember the same words every night and be standing in the same, and we just argued.
See, that's what I think is the issue with comedians as actors. So I think as screen actors, I don't see it as a difficult thing.
Yeah.
But I think, like, well, it's also actors being different parts. Like, do you know what I mean? So, like, you could, certain actors, whoever, you know, pick someone, you go, like, let's say Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis doing Shakespeare. And, he's a very talented actor. You just go, nah, I'm not really buying it. Mm-hmm. I know Mel Gibson did Hamlet. And, that kind of, you would go, nah. Whereas comedians, I think we could easily act in something.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it'd be incredibly believable and impressive. I think we've seen loads of examples.
Yeah.
But I think that thing of remembering that, you know, Hamlet, the soliloquy and Hamlet.
I remember seeing Eddie Izzard playing Lenny Bruce.
Wow.
In the West End. And the stories that kept coming out of that show, because it was when Eddie was at his kind of absolute UK peak, you know, he would announce a run in the West End and it would sell out. And then he said, he's going to do Lenny, he's going to do this play Lenny Bruce. And there's a bit where in the middle he'd do a set. So it was just, it was a play. The girl from Showgirls, is that the awful film?
Yes. Elizabeth Berkley.
Elizabeth Berkley played Lenny's...
Oh, right, Valerie Perrine in the movie. Yeah.
So Berkley played his... Yeah. Where? Yes. Yeah, thank you, sir. The Valerie Perrine part. Wow. That was Elizabeth Berkeley. Now, a couple of things that were happening apparently during the run were that they had a scene together where they were both naked and Eddie was reacting.
Oh. Acting is reacting.
On stage. He was going a bit method.
He'd a bigger part than expected.
Well, this is what we heard, and apparently there were complaints.
Night after night.
But because what is illegal on stage is an erection.
Yeah.
You can be naked on stage, that's but you can't be aroused. So apparently there were complaints to the Chancellor's office about Eddie Izzard having wood on stage.
Oh, my God.
This is what I heard. But the thing that his other cast members were complaining about, and it wasn't the stiffy, funnily enough, was that there's the bit in it where he does a set at a little coffee club in New York, to be. Mm-hmm. But Eddie, in the middle of a play, starts doing stand-up. And it got to the point, so it's supposed to be like a 15-minute chunk of the play.
Half an hour?
It was 40 minutes one night.
Oh, wow. Is he doing it as Lenny Bruce?
Yeah. But he starts to just...
Ad-lib.
He's doing stand-up, he starts riffing. But he's... So there were... I remember that being in time out, that people were... punters were complaining because they were missing their trains.
I'm getting annoyed.
I'm coming down late.
I'm seeing Eddie Izzard do stand-up. It's really annoying.
As Lenny Bruce.
But, you know, fair play to committing to the part.
Yeah. One of the greatest reviews I ever read was Kitson in Brighton at the Brighton Comedy Festival. And the guy reviewing it said, Daniel Kitson saw I was here. So he started going, oh, you staying the night? And he goes, no, I'm getting the last train back. So he kept staying on to try and make me miss the train. So the review was about Kitson and your man, Kitson staying on
going back
stage
and forth
so that he'd make the reviewer miss his train. And your man went, I made my train. And it was just, the review of the show was just a small part of it. Yeah.
It was just a petty back and forth, basically. It's such,
reading the pettiness was so funny.
But obviously music is such a big thing, Phil. And like for me, it is as well. Like for me, everything goes back to music, just for me personally. But like, does film play a big part, or TV or anything like that?
Well, growing up, it's strange to be in the position we are now with the media, you know, and the fact that everything is available in some form.
Yeah.
I could have the thought now that, I'd quite like to see Lone Wolf and Cub, the Japanese kind of adaptation, live action adaptation of the manga from the 1950s. And I could get on
have
phone
a tear in the bag
and have a little... have a little poke around and I could find it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, when I was a kid, you know, before video, I always remember that when I'd go and see a film, like I'd go and see a James Bond, my mum would take me to see the new James Bond. I remember seeing Diamonds Are Forever. I remember coming out of Diamonds Are Forever. And I remember being sad coming out of Diamonds Are Forever, thinking, that's not going to be on telly for 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm that was not going to see that again for 4 years, and that was so good. I didn't like get another quid out of my purse and go and see it again because it was that good. And it's really weird because I've been listening to this. There's a podcast in America called I can't even remember what the bloody thing's called, but and they talk about when they were kids, and they talk about the fact that if they really loved, they go back and see it again.
I think
there's a different sensibility, maybe. But for me, it's like you saw a film and that was it; you'd seen it. Yeah.
I did that for Pulp Fiction. Went straight back in. And I enjoyed it probably more the second time.
I was only about 7 when that came out.
Whatever.
And I was going to see Babe in the cinema. Yeah. And I accidentally walked into Pulp Fiction.
Good Lord.
And it was the moment Uma Thurman is having the
OD.
I was traumatised. I ran.
I was traumatised by the farmer killing the otter in Ring of Bright Water. Very different thing, but a similar action. Stand down.
But it's true, isn't it, though? Like, I remember there used to be a video rental shop at the end of the road down by the church where we grew up, and I would always look out for what I enjoyed in the cinema probably a year and a half before. You'd see the poster first. Free Willy, Dumb and Dumber.
Coming next week.
And whatever. You know, and you go, oh, it must be coming out on video now. But the other night, myself and
Thank God you didn't say DVD, I'd have felt really old.
No, God, no. But it's true, though. And even back when you'd have a video, you might only own like 4 videos.
Yeah.
You know, even when DVDs came out, I have probably 300 DVDs up in the attic. But nowadays, you can't figure out what to watch because there's just so much to watch.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, what I do like, and I just, what I wish, what is annoying to me, and all of the interfaces of all of the streamers are visually based, and I want them, I think that because we're paying for their service and we should be able to opt into this, there should just be a list, verbal, just words,
yeah,
a list, alphabetical list of films, and I'd much prefer that to this constantly swiping through.
You might like this.
Films, yeah, suggestions. I don't want suggestions.
Yeah.
You know, if I see a name that I recognise, I've got some of the works with language, if I see a name I recognise, but I did, you know, you find, every once in a while, you'll find a really weird little gem of a film, and, you know, you'll watch it. It's, I like that. I like talking to people about films, and I always try and get at least one recommendation of something I've not seen. I mean, it's negligent of me in the extreme, but I'd never seen The Third Man. Carol Reed's The Third Man before.
I haven't seen it either.
Oh my God.
Jesus, yeah, man, you need to watch
it. Just
the Third
for the music
Man.
Alone, just I listen know. To it.
Well, you can do that. He's not wrong. Mm. But visually, in terms of the art of film, watch The Third Man.
It's amazing,
Carol Reed's Third Man. You'll be just, at the end of it, you're like, how can I not have had this in my life?
Yeah.
It's absolutely,
that
it's
is
gorgeous.
Stunning. That is the ultimate, isn't it?
And it's post-war Vienna. Even, I'm trying to think, I was in Vienna and I was in a, and there's a, I can't think of her name now, the female actor in it, she's Austrian, and they've named a sandwich after her in the restaurant. I was looking and going, I know her.
It's very Larry David.
I couldn't work out how I knew her, and then it was like, oh, she's in The Third Man. It's a gorgeous movie.
About comedy then, Phil? What's your early kind of comedy?
Well, you know, and so that conceit that comedy was someone in a suit telling jokes.
Yeah.
A list of jokes. And going through them.
Here's another one. Here's another one.
Yeah, just going bang, 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 bang. And I'm like, I didn't understand how that could be done. But bear in mind, so I'm born in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm 10 and you're starting to kind of develop, so 72, Python.
Yeah.
So then, and also then before that, my stepdad is making me listen to The Goons.
Okay.
So just that kind of silliness.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that comedy can be situational and can be absurd, mm-hmm. and can be, but my biggest, I would say that my biggest thing in terms of just laughter is Tex Avery cartoons, who was the main director for Warner Brothers up until 1938 when he went to MGM. He was one of the creators of Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig.
Oh, wow. All right.
Then he went on to do Droopy and Barney Bear, sort of less successful.
That's going to happen as he got older.
You know. But he just, I think if you watch the visual humour, you know, it's like you're talking about people who comedically are being influenced by the speed of vaudeville. So the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they're kind of taking the mick out of the people of the time. So you get jokes about, like, Edward G. Robinson in cartoons. And I'm like a 10-year-old kid in Essex.
Yeah, you have homework. Oh,
watching this. And then when you see things later, you're like, mm-hmm. What I like about, what's really interesting for me about the comedy I liked as a kid is when I rewatch it as an adult, firstly, and this is sacrilege, I'm sorry, I don't think Python was all that.
Okay. The actual Flying Circus.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think there's bits in it amazing. But
I don't think
the consistency was
there. It
wasn't
consistent. Yeah. No. Well, and I think that once they limited themselves, I think that the greatest thing they ever did was Holy Grail. And that's it.
Right.
I think Life of Brian was an attempt to do Holy Grail again and to make some spurious kind of undergraduate points about religion.
Yeah. But the first thing I ever saw
Life of Brian was
Life of Brian.
Yeah. Life of Brian
was
a huge thing.
My dad showed it to me one night and he probably shouldn't have. He was like, well, I got this. And it blew my mind.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, as a 10-year-old boy in Ireland. But what I will say is, is it Terry Jones does the animation? Terry Gilliam does that.
Yeah.
That took, like, when he falls out of the thing and it goes off in the spaceship, I was like, this is ridiculous.
That's the one bit I don't like.
But the funny thing is then Gilliam goes on to make some of the Gilliam trilogy. Mm-hmm. So
The Fisher King,
Time Bandits, Brazil, and Munchausen, which are a trilogy about the little boy in Time Bandits, Jonathan Pryce in Brazil, and Munchausen himself. It's the three ages of man. It's a trilogy. Right.
Oh wow. I never knew that.
So that's how you have to watch them. Yeah, if you watch them with that sensibility, you go, okay. Mm-hmm. Gilliam, I love.
What do you like when you rewatch something now? So if you go, oh, I haven't watched this since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Is your mind take, oh my God, this is a whole different thing for me now?
Has that happened much? Well, there's a couple of things. I listened to all of the Python. I bought all of the Python albums the last time I did a UK tour. So that was about 8 years ago. And so I listened to all the Python albums. And so, that was a joke. Oh, right. So I got a lot of stuff I didn't get.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, right, I get that now. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that. But basically, older now, I think that the British have this really strange kind of void that needs to be filled with silliness.
Okay.
Childishness.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that it needs to be... I'm not the man to do it. I'm not into doing a PhD. But I think that whole Crazy Gang, Goons, Python, Vic and Bob, Boosh.
Yeah.
There's always some... League of Gentlemen.
Harry Hill.
I don't think Harry's in. I think Harry's from a, because he's a solo performer. He's more like from the Max Miller, Max Wall tradition. That solo kind of performer. As a solo, it's a different thing. I think a group of lads together being
whimsical, kind of
and loud, and being alphas, being surrealist alphas.
Yeah, like we don't have that over here. Like I don't think you could find an example. Maybe I'm incorrect, but I definitely think, like a lot of people go, you go British humor, you think sarcasm, bleakness, you know, laughing at kind of the bleakness of life or whatever, but. I think a lot of people miss that when you're talking about British humour because it is a huge staple, the whimsicalness, the silliness of it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you've just chronicled the history, essentially, of British comedy there, and it's a big backbone.
Well, the spectrum, I mean, we'd have had, like, Hancock to be quite dark and stuff like that, you know, and to a degree, Steptoe and Son. And even, I know it's a bit of a stretch, but Dad's Army, because you're talking about a dark time.
No, but that's what I'm talking about, bleak.
Yeah, so you're talking about the bleakness, but it's still finding, but it's not quite
but
silly.
The absurdist silliness is to me.
But that, it's the British were very good at put some archetypes in a room and watch them interact. Which is what Dad's Army is, which is what Steptoe is.
Mm. Yeah.
Porridge is that.
Mm. Are you
Porridge
being
is just, let's look at Britain.
But you'd have the class system clearly defined, which we don't have. That's the one big difference, I think, with the British comedy. And certainly for me, going over, I used to like reading, I'd buy 3 or 4 papers a day, especially if I was over for a weekend, just, you know, bored.
Yeah.
And I'd see other comedians going, why are you reading The Guardian? And I'm going, the next day, why have you got a tabloid? And I'm going, I read a few papers and I'm not defined by what I read.
Mm-hmm. And
what's wrong with reading all the different viewpoints?
As a lad, I didn't work out for me. I was an apprentice in a print place and the guy was showing me how to do graphic design, bless him. And I was there for about 6 months. A fellow called Dick used to run the place. And Dick read The Guardian and The Sun every day.
Yeah.
And I never forgot that. But he read both.
To me, that's totally. I'm not. Yeah. I wouldn't do it. I remember I'd go to like the London Independent. I used to read.
Yeah.
But I'd read a tabloid, and I'd happily, if it's a paper I haven't seen, I'd happily pick up any paper.
Yeah.
And go through it.
I think. So getting back to that, it's interesting you sort of talking about that sort of class thing and kind of not going to preconceptions and not sticking with. The thing that surprised me most about becoming a professional comedian, then looking back at some of the stuff that made me laugh, is I didn't like Python as much. I didn't have as much respect for it. I knew the bits that were good were great, but I'm not one of these old Python was everything.
Yeah.
But solo performers, I think I got more respect for. So I remember seeing Steve Martin on Parkinson, and that completely changed my life. And that's not an exaggeration to say that. He sits down opposite
Steve,
Michael.
That's weird that Steve down, Martin is the one that...
No, he sits down opposite Michael Parkinson. He's just done some... He's done Ramblin' Man on the banjo with the arrow through his
arrow head. Arrow through the head, yeah.
And he sits down opposite Parkinson and, Steve, thank you for coming on the show. And then he leans across with a pair of scissors and cuts Parkinson's tie in half and puts it in his pocket. Right. Okay. Now... Imagine what an American chat show host would do with that.
Yeah.
Michael Parkinson's response to a guest cutting his tie in half was, "Mary bought me that."
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, that's great.
People talk about him as being the UK's Johnny Carson. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't get it.
There was a...
That's so funny.
There was I remember, I think it was, it must have been the word, Whitney Houston. And with hindsight now, you realise she was on drugs. But I thought she was drunk at the time. Yeah. And you can just see her, she's off her face. And they're talking about, I think, in my memory is Terry Christian going, "So you're learning to shoot. You know, you've got a gun at home now." She goes, yeah, if anyone ever breaks into my house, I'm going to shoot them. I have no problem shooting to kill. And I'm watching this going... Whitney Houston is talking about defending her house with a gun. And I'm going, oh my God, this is incredible. Next question. So tell us about the new album. And I went, if ever there's a follow-up question, if ever there's a, right, we don't need the cards. Yeah. Let's push on.
Let's keep on going.
I can't remember exactly, but it was Whitney Houston going, yeah. Tell us about the new album.
Yeah. It's, I just... The fact that you've got all the choice now, but then you've got the wisdom of experience, and so you can be a bit more kind of, oh, I'd like to see this, I'd like to see that. But I still, my greatest resource is friends, and when they tell me things, oh, you've got to watch this, you've got to watch that. And I think that we must, you know, it's... Whereas it's nice to have things suggested by your phones and the bloody AIs, it's not... Ultimately, I think it's better just get recommendations from people you like. It's like... I do remember... You know, that kind of when you read a review of a film and it slags it off. And if you trust the reviewer, you think, oh, I don't like that. Whereas now, I've been past plays and films and I've seen comments from punters.
Yeah.
If I wanted some random dingbat to recommend me a play, I would go into a random pub in the middle of nowhere, find a random dingbat and go, what play should I go to? I don't I don't care what some idiot thinks about. If you have...
Full of typos.
If you've been a reviewer, I heart that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
I heart this. Mm. If you've been a reviewer for years and I now, as a reader of your work, have a relationship with you, but this kind of, you know... approval of product by committee.
Yeah.
I'm done.
I remember someone putting up they had 5 reviews in Edinburgh, 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, 5-star, put them all up on the board.
Yeah.
And I went, that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true.
This is something for everybody. You might hate this, you might love it.
Yeah. You know? That's way more endearing, isn't it, than the idea of everything is 5 stars.
Yeah. I don't know. Gary Delaney had a great thing. He was telling me, I don't know if he ever did it, for his head for my Edinburgh poster, I'm going to put up 5 stars, The Scotsman, 5 stars, The Guardian, blah, blah, blah. All these newspapers, I think they're excellent. And I was like, that's brilliant. You've already now made, you know, you made the audience laugh.
Yeah.
If they're not following it, they'll go. And if they are following it, they're going, oh, that's very funny, I'll go see the show. It's a perfect poster.
Yeah.
Well, look, we don't want to keep Phil here forever. He's doing a show.
Yes, we do.
And you're doing a show.
We were
and
told
I'm
to keep
not.
Him.
But that's just the way things are going at the moment. Phil, thank you so much. Honestly, we met last year in Galway.
I know,
I said to
yeah.
Carol straight away, and I said, we have to have Phil come on this podcast.
No, thank you. Any time. I don't think we didn't really even scratch the surface.
We barely
of some
did.
Of the
oh, we got things. We got his Lou Reed.
Actually, before we cut off, first gig you ever went to, first band you ever
saw? The first proper gig. I saw local bands locally, but U2.
U2? Where was that?
It was New Year's Eve in the Point Depot, 89 into 90, and it was broadcast all over the place.
Yeah.
And it was about the third song before I saw a member of U2, because I was up the front.
Wow.
At midnight, they came on at midnight, and balloons dropped. I didn't realize. I was kind of watching, what's all this stuff on the ground later? The crush, everything was mental. I got to see it. It was on, the first two songs were broadcast on TV. Yeah. I saw them when I got home. So I got a bus home. I was home at like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
But it was, God, the 90s are going to be something. And possibly the next gig was Frank Sinatra.
Oh my God.
That's a good two.
I think it was U2, Sinatra and the Pixies. That's what I'm talking about, eclectic music.
Yeah.
And Sinatra, you could see he was a bit, not quite. Actually, it was, Junior was the conductor.
Yeah.
And he'd go, this was written by an arranged, was it Nelson Riddle?
Yeah
it was.
He's
doing all this.
Yeah.
Was it arranged by Nelson Riddle? But there was a lovely moment at the start. It's announced, ladies and gentlemen, the show will commence in 5 minutes. And then it was, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Sinatra. None of this. Old Blue Eyes. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and he walked on, come fly with me. And a woman ran up to take a picture. And he timed it beautifully. Come fly with me, come fly. Pause. Click, cry until
I love that.
And the place are just going,
Your first gig.
Well, I was just going to say, I hope he doesn't come to me, because my first gig that I went to on my own behalf was Aslan, the Irish band, Christy Dignam.
Yeah.
Like, legitimately idolized Christy Dignam.
Yeah, I
cried when he died, like legitimately had the song in the car. Anyway, but the first actual gig I went to was my sister was going to see Five.
Nice.
At the Point
Get
Depot.
On up when you're down.
And our friend was supposed to go with her, and our friend was homesick from school that day, and I went. So my very first gig is actually Five at the Point Depot.
I have a Christy story. I used to work in Abracababra, Phibsborough.
Yeah.
And Christy used to come in regularly, and we used to same regulars come in after the pub on the corner every Friday night. And I was looking at him, and you go, oh, that's chicken baguette. And then one night he just looked up and smiled and went, oh geez, that's your man from Aslan, Christy Dignam. So I said to one of the girls, I said, you know Chicken Baguette? And she goes, yeah, that's the lead singer of Aslan. He goes, oh, I thought he was addicted to heroin. I says, yeah, but Chicken Baguette. He goes, I suppose you have to replace the heroin with something. And I had the pleasure of telling Christy that.
He loved
I was
that.
On the Ray Darcy radio show with him, and he was going, oh, I used to love Chicken Baguette, yeah. He was a lovely fella.
Loved him.
And Chicken Baguette.
This has been an absolute pleasure. There's nothing I love more than, you know. I think just talking about stuff like this, it's something that's what, with me not gigging anymore, I suppose it's something I don't get to
dress
do so
much. It's like a warm hug.
It is,
I have such a fond love of the dressing room, a nice green room. Like, I love doing gigs, I love being on stage, but a nice green room can be the reason. I, you know, a weekend away and you just go, and we're just having the crack. You're almost going, oh, I have to go on. I've had so many that kind of little back and forth.
It's funny enough, I was with a mate last night, and I was chatting about a time just after Don Ward had moved the Comedy Store from the square itself around the corner to Piccadilly. And I don't know if there'd been a bomb or something. Probably you lot. Anyway, there'd been...
I was fine.
Something had happened in London. And it was a Friday late show. I was on. Sean Locke. I think it might have been Sean Meo. Brandy, I think, was on. Maybe Kevin Day. Solid bill. Me comparing. Yeah. Really good bill.
Few Palace fans.
Yeah, you know. And 12 people in the audience.
Wow.
And so, or was there snow and a bomb? I don't know. Swiss terrorists? I don't know.
We're getting blamed for the snow as well, are we? Yeah.
Anyway, but all I remember, I just remember that night, I'm pretty sure we knew the names of all 12 people.
Oh, but
and
yeah,
by
yeah.
the time the last act went on, it became a conversation between.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Dave, you. Everyone knew it was weird that the green room vibe spilled out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there was enough of it to sort of percolate. And we just remember it as a very. I just remember it. Lockie especially, haven't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just being a really well, weird...
That sounds
because I remember us asking, as Saint Estan, who used to be the stage manager there, oh, God, can we kick it in a touch? Can we just fucking go home? And he went, the rule is, if there's more of them than you, you got to do it. That, which is the old theatre rule.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
there's more audience than cast, you have to do the show.
Wow.
Yeah. There's I'm a huge fan of Sean Lott, and I didn't know him well, but I did gigs across the north
I
with
love
him.
This.
And have I told you the story?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's great.
And I gigged with him in Galway and stuff and done a few things with him, but I didn't know him. And so we do, I think it's 3 or 4 dates. He was doing a work in progress, but he's family from up the north.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So we're up there and we're going around during the day, out for lunch, and we're hanging out. And I was on my best behavior. I'm like, you know, be quieter, don't be talking all the time, all this sort of thing. And the last gig, I think it was in Cookstown, and I was just there. He was, during the interval, I was heading off. He was going on. I'd seen him. I was driving home. And I went, Sean, thanks a million for giving me the gigs. I really had such a great time. And he goes, do you know what? Thanks for not being one of those guys always talking, always trying to make me laugh. You know, you were just perfect company. And I went, but Sean, I was. And it made him laugh so much. It was almost worth the long game. And I think he was told to go, oh, Carl is fun, but he won't shut up.
Yeah.
So he obviously had asked someone.
Yeah.
I just felt, but I had been such good. And I listened, you know. It's like the time you had the radio show in Galway and John Cooper Clark was one of the other guests. And the guy managed.
Tom Rhodes and Johnny Green, yeah.
And Johnny Green.
Wow, from
the,
my God.
Tom managed The Clash. And I just remember sitting there and they, Johnny Cooper Clark and Johnny Green came in and I just remember going, shut up, Carl, and listen. And I was that's, and I'm even going, well done. That's the smartest thing you've thought of in a long time. And it was amazing just listening to stories. And I was going, I didn't care. I was just happy to be there listening. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing experience.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation.
Yeah.
We can.
Off microphone.
Yeah, don't tell him.
Phil, thank you so much.
Thanks, man.